Hello and welcome to the 2021 season of the FinTech Newscast. Welcome. A few things have gone on since we last saw you in December. And here with me to talk about it is Steve.
Hey, John. Happy New Year.
I said that like a question, Steve. You are there, right?
I'm here. Yes, I can attest that I'm here. Yeah.
Great. And we're lucky to have Sean with us this week.
Hey, John. Happy to be here. Happy 2021. Brand new year.
Yeah. Too bad nothing's going on and we have nothing to talk about.
It's so bored, calm, huh? You know?
Yeah, it's just boring. Well, there is a lot of exciting stuff coming up around the bend for FinTech in 2021. And I wanted to talk about some of the IPOs that we see coming up. All those VCs and employees and lucky shareholders are looking to cash in on some of this huge ramp up in valuations over the past year.
Yeah, it seems to be a pretty heated market. We've also seen, you know, I think from the middle of last year, sort of the rise of the SPAC as well. So I'm actually quite keen to see what happens in the IPO market, both in SPACs and in traditional IPOs in 2021.
Yeah, SPACs were a big story for 2020 as well. And SoFi is going through a SPAC. That's a special purpose acquisition company. Basically, they merge with the target company, in this case, SoFi, to get their shares out in the public. And all of these are great valuations for the company. I don't know if they're great valuations for the investors, but they're looking at around an $8.7 billion valuation. And as we're here in early January, that's the price, unless negotiations break down or something happens. That looks like it's solid to go through in the next few weeks.
That's awesome. Yeah, I wonder how, is there a delta between that listing price and their fundraising as well? I'm assuming they haven't raised $8 billion, but I wonder whether their private valuation will match what they want to get in the public markets.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's the overall valuation. On the float, the number of shares they're going to put out is much, much less than that. And SoFi has been pretty active. They're the ones who bought Galileo, the payments technology company. I think it was April of last year, which was also a large acquisition, a large transaction.
SoFi has done such a good job at capturing some of the younger population too for refinancing student debt and making a really like solid platform, easy to use. I personally am a fan of SoFi. I think I've always been impressed by their marketing. They've like done a good job at, they'll, you know, drop like Kanye West lyrics in an ad. One ad I saw recently was "Get Your Money Right," and I thought it kind of made me turn my head because that's a line from Kanye West's song, and they just put it on billboard for people to refinance their student loans. I thought it was good overall. I'm not surprised that SoFi is crushing it, and I think it'll be exciting to see how their IPO pans out.
Have you ever used their services, Sean? Because you're actually, I think, out of the three of us, you're the one that's closest to the one who most recently graduated. And I know that SoFi initially was sort of recent graduate thing. Yeah, exactly.
I have not used it personally, but I've had friends who used it and they've kind of said the same thing. It's easy to use and they seem to really understand the demographic. So to the extent that they're justifying valuation by like capturing this demographic, the younger demographic, I think they're doing a good job.
Awesome.
Yeah, another company that's kind of catching the zeitgeist lately, especially during the pandemic, is Affirm. You know, they're doing the buy now, pay later kind of thing. Their valuation has doubled just in the past 2 months to $10 billion. And this is a little bit of a risky item because of the concentration risk. Almost one third of their revenues come just from Peloton purchases.
I wonder whether they're actually going to strike while the iron is hot because, you know, with everyone buying Pelotons now because of the pandemic and also just IPO prices going so crazy, I think this is the right move for them. But I'm not sure whether this is a sustainable long-term business, especially because there's a lot of other competing players like Klarna and Afterpay, right? Both in Australia and in Europe. So it seems like it's sort of not a very differentiated product and also heavily concentrated. I don't know. I'm a bit skeptical about this one.
And plus the large banks have just barely started to dip their toes into this market as well. It's very small in the US. I think it's less than 2% or something of purchases compared to like 20, 25% in some countries in Europe and in Australia where this has really taken off. It's much larger. So there could be a lot of room to grow. But yes, right, a lot of stiff competition as well. And they're looking to raise about $1 billion out of this. So about 10% of the shares of the company will be available.
That's a hefty chunk. I think the last number I saw was like $4 billion. So yeah, it's amazing how it's nowadays you can double.
Right. They saw what happened. I think in this case, they saw what happened with Airbnb and DoorDash. The prices shot up after the issuance. And so they waited so that they could capture more of that price rise. So they've kind of ramped it up because there's this appetite. As we know, there's a bubble in everything right now. So, and the biggest IPO potentially for the year is Stripe. They're looking at between $70 and $100 billion valuation. And they've been, again, another big beneficiary of the pandemic, the e-commerce boom that's risen up as a result. And they're expanding into larger companies. They've been focused on smaller companies and startups, but now they're starting to have much larger partners, you know, well-known names, as well as expanding. They bought a company in Africa. They've been expanding in other countries as well. So there's a lot of potential with this company as well.
Yeah, it's. I know that we don't cover politics here, but it's interesting to note that Stripe was one of the companies that actually has deplatformed President Trump, so they will no longer process any payments on his website, which again kind of speaks to the effect that all these tech companies have on our lives and the power they have on our lives. But I'm wondering how either you two feel about this process or this policy of deplatforming people that maybe they don't agree with.
I think it's, Steve, interesting point. I saw that in the headlines too, and definitely captured my attention. It makes me think more about like the whole concept of software eating the world. So like tech companies are just eating the world, right? We're everywhere. It's everything from Apple for your hardware to your telecommunications to Stripe for your small business, your campaign, whatever it may be. The omnipresence of the, you know, in this case, fintechs in the payments world and in the you know, and the economy as a whole is very interesting because it goes to that point, tech is eating the world. And in this case, fintech is eating the world. So companies like Stripe can justify those valuations with the fact that they are really present in a lot of areas of life.
They're everywhere for sure. Yeah, two other companies that have become kind of household names in the past year or two, Robinhood and Coinbase are looking at IPOs in the next few months as well. Coinbase is the largest crypto exchange in the US. And people are looking at this as really validating, as one of the further steps, I should say, in validating Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and bringing more investors in the market with this kind of, you know, establishment kind of a move. You know, it's a public company or soon will be. And they're looking at a $28 billion valuation, at least that's the target. And the other one is Robinhood with an $11.7 billion valuation. You know, this trading platform has taken off hugely in 2020, and they're looking to go public in the next 2 months.
So if you're able to get in early on one of those stocks, Sean, would you go Coinbase or Robinhood?
You know, I think both of those companies have proven that they can perform in the market. And so I would say you can't really go wrong with either. I think one of the interesting things about Robinhood is just that influx of traders they had come in 2020 just flooded into Robinhood, especially if you remember March of last year. It was the whole like trader bro, retail bro, whatever you want to call it, who kind of just, you know, the David Portnoy crowd from Barstool Sports just going in and signing up for Robinhood accounts. They've really crushed it. I'm really impressed with their growth. And they've expanded into crypto pretty heavily as well. So there's an opportunity for them to capture multiple markets. And they've similar to SoFi, they've really mastered their demographic. And I think they've done a good job at marketing to them, which goes to justify that valuation, at least somewhat justified. I'm not sure it 100% justifies it, but they are making good traction there.
Yeah, that might be a case. If you buy it now, you might pay later.
Yes.
There you go.
Good job. So a follow-up question here. If you think of the way the companies like Airbnb have performed, right? They've succeeded in spite of the pandemic, not because of it. I sort of see Robinhood as being sort of a pandemic success story as well, right? People with both their stimulus checks, time at home, kind of that willingness to gamble, boredom, have really taken to the platform. Do you think this will be a sustainable thing, or will this drop off once we go back to whatever normal looks like, say 3-4 months from now?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, are they going to incur revenue losses when we go back to the bars and have beers versus sitting on our couch and trading Bitcoin frantically? I'm not sure. I think it will certainly cause a dent in some of those numbers. If you take a look at some of the potential downward pressure on a lot of prices because of this, we might see that change. But other than that, I think, you know, people are still going to have a desire to trade. They've been kind of welcomed into this new world of investing, and they've seen that they can make good returns in a good market. If you just put, you know, a few hundred dollars in SPY, you know, over these past few months, you probably did well, right? I mean, it's a market that you really can't lose money in right now unless you're making just wildly crazy moves. So people have a good taste in their mouth when it comes to investing. So those things combined, I think, are going to cause a situation where we're not going to have people just drop off the face of the earth on their Robinhood accounts. They probably will be less active, but they've still started to gain some momentum on the platform. So I don't see a big drop off there. That's just my personal prediction.
Okay, yeah, we might see some of these valuations continue to skyrocket and some maybe drop off a little bit. We'll find out when the tide goes out who is really wearing shorts or not. But
what do you think? Do you think this sort of like pandemic growth for these companies is sustainable? Or,
well, I think these valuations are pretty, you know, baking in a long way into the future already. So I don't know how long that can be sustained. You know, was it Keynes that was saying the market can be irrational longer than you can stay solvent? So some of these, I just don't know if Robinhood can differentiate enough or market enough to be different from, you know, everybody else that has free trades now to sustain that valuation, or if it just, what we think will happen is we'll zoom away when things get back to normal. So yeah, it's hard to tell. I think Coinbase is a solid future. So yeah, we'll see what happens. I wouldn't promise anything to anybody on these names, but we should see most of these IPOs happen in the next few months. But unfortunately, one of Steve's favorite companies has already died an ignominious death in 2021.
Well, they haven't quite died yet, but they're definitely under deathbed, and we have a date when they're going to pull a plug. That's a kind of a long analogy. Yeah, I know, it's sad. So the company Simple, which was acquired by BBVA, the Spanish bank, maybe about a year and a half, 2 years ago, has been sort of in this slow death spiral. So maybe 4 or 5 years ago, Simple really became the company at the vanguard of the whole digital banking movement. They had all these envelopes where you could save money. They were sort of seen as a direct competitor to Chime, which has been, you know, on a tear recently, along with N26 and Nubank and so on and so forth. But Simple, after they were acquired again by BBVA, kind of suffered from that fate that a lot of companies go through, which is that, you know, a big slow company acquires them, they become less innovative, less dynamic, they release product less frequently. And then lo and behold, now that PNC acquired the US assets of BBVA, they're basically just going to write it off and wind the whole thing down, which is just terrible, terrible news.
Yeah, the downside of getting acquired. I mean, even if you get the money, your dream of taking over the world dies in a committee at a much larger bank.
Yeah, it's really a shame because I worked on a product maybe 3 years ago that was sort of that was looking at Simple for some product guidance. I'm gonna frame it that way, and they really did come up with a lot of really interesting things that are very much like customer focused, and you know all the kind of things that all the neobanks say they are, but they really walk the walk. You know, again, like 5 years ago or so. So it's also, this will be a huge blow to the Portland startup scene. I know that Simple was at some point the largest startup employer, I think in the state of Oregon as well, which is interesting.
That's a bummer. Oh man.
Yeah.
Portland has so many good things come out of it. Also a lot of good music out of Portland. So seeing a Portland native company go bust, that hurts to hear.
It's a shame. But you know, I think this means that hopefully a lot of the philosophies that Simple helped to pioneer will become more widely adopted by the bigger banks. Who knows? Or maybe just Chime and others will kind of fill in that spot. But I'm still hopeful that we can have a sustainable digital first banking product for the mass retail space.
Yeah, and there's so many players jumping into this market. You know, we've talked about big tech, Google, Amazon, Apple jumping into the market as well for fintech products. But something new just came out. I saw Walmart is now going to start its own fintech. And
What?
That's wild.
So you can have your Wall checking account. Now, this isn't exactly new news. In terms of Walmart jumping into financials, they've tried to get a bank license before, about 2 years ago, I think it was, and they were denied. There was a lot of pushback on that, not least of which from other large banks. They do offer a lot of services with their partner Green Dot, like check cashing, debit cards, that sort of thing. And I was kind of curious how Green Dot stock would do after Walmart announced that they would, well, basically replace them with their own in-house services. They're actually not doing too bad. They had some, maybe in anticipation of this move, they've made a lot of announcements about new products to help underserved people get access to banking services. So their stock has actually done pretty well, despite this what will probably be a separation from a huge company, from Walmart, in the next few months or years, as Walmart starts to develop its own products and its own branding. So they've picked a really great partner to do this with, a company called Ribbit Capital. It's a VC fund that's worked with Affirm, Robinhood, and Credit Karma before. So there's just a ton of experience with this VC. So they picked a really good partner, which bodes well for their success. They haven't announced exactly what the details are yet. It's just announced, and I'm sure they're going to hash through it. This is an organization, Walmart, with 4,700 stores, which would make them the second or third largest bank in terms of branches, at least in the US. So just a huge presence, and maybe they can take this all the way and not get stopped at the banking license level. And so this is really, I think it's more competition for fintechs because they're targeting more underserved, underbanked kind of customers rather than customers of large banks.
They've actually also taken part in some really interesting and some other really interesting fintech stuff as well. They had a partnership with a company called Even out of Oakland that basically enabled their employees to access their paychecks ahead of schedule, right? It was a paycheck advance company, and I know that the employees are basically Walmart is what the second or third largest private employer in the U.S. So they've done sort of really interesting tests with fintech now, but I love the idea of them deploying more financial services, getting into this space as well, and maybe even getting a banking license. I think that the more of that we have, the better, especially if it's done with, you know, under the right regulation and sort of under the right growth controls as well. So go Walmart. Something I never thought I would say, go Walmart.
That's increasingly a discussion, the right kind of regulation. The industrial license that Walmart was trying to get before was very controversial as kind of too minimal and not really providing the protections and regulations that other banks have to go through, other financial services have to maintain. So that's kind of been a discussion over, you know, sandboxing or ILC or people doing kind of a regulatory arbitrage, providing the services without having to comply or set aside capital. So that might be a discussion as Walmart heads towards a banking license.
Walmart going for a banking license. It's just the thought of those two things together is just wild.
And that's what caused a lot of the pushback the last time they tried to get their license. Now they're just talking fintech services right now. You can see if that goes well, that's where they would inevitably head. So this might be a challenge for fintechs that are going for these underserved kind of customers. So, you know, they may have this huge competitor with these 4,700 branches where they have millions of people going through their stores. And instead of using Chime or one of the other challenger banks or services, you know, if Walmart starts offering these salary advance or kind of a convenience services or not charging fees for overdraft, which has been a big attraction for the challenger banks, they might be able to pull away some of that market share, which I'm sure that's what they're betting on.
There's an interesting bifurcation in fintech as well, where famously, right, the profile of people who use Venmo over the Cash App is quite different. Venmo is a lot more coastal, more, you know, young professional millennials, let's call them, where Cash App is more a bit lower income, more in the Southeast, the Midwest. So maybe we'll see the, you know, the Walmart fintech kind of servicing that market and not really the Venmo, Chime, N26 market on the coast.
Interesting. So they kind of carve out of their own little niche potentially and master that market.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's just advertising or the way in which these things are allowed, but there's definitely a difference in the profile of users of the Cash App and Venmo and PayPal. So I could see this being sort of a solution for, you know, the Southwest, the South, and the Midwest, and the coast remain more tied to an actual bank instead.
So pulling out your Walmart card might not have the same cachet as a Goldman Sachs kind of card.
Not if you're getting your sweet, you know, your sweet green salad. You know, it's just not as cool.
Imagine someone ripping that out in San Francisco at a bar or something. Just bring out your Walmart card. Wonder how people would react.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. There's certainly a marketing aspect as well. But Walmart already has tens of millions of customers and a huge base. So whatever they match with will still be a huge market. So, well, let's see if Walmart takes off as well as Bitcoin has in the past month or so, I think it is. What do you think, Sean?
I love how you brought those two concepts together, John. So this is a watershed moment for Bitcoin and for crypto. We saw a historic bull run a few weeks ago, followed by a pretty big price correction. So, you know, strap in. It's been a wild ride for these past few weeks. First, we had a 42K all-time high for Bitcoin. And then a plummet down to losing almost a third of its value, going back down to 32. Pretty big correction immediately. And I think the interesting thing here to watch is, how does Bitcoin perform without the hype? And now that we're sort of seeing these long-term institutional investors move big sums of money into the asset class. And so really, like, the big picture here is that there's going to be volatility. So if you hold this, if you are in this world, like, you know, that volatility like this that we saw these past few weeks is normal. Because crypto has gotten a bit more mainstream, people now are looking at, you know, seeing in the news, there's a lot of discussion and talk, which is good for the world. But at the same time, volatility is something that this world knows really well. So expect a lot more volatility is my personal opinion on that. I think we're going to see a lot of rise and decline as this asset class matures. So at the same time, we're also seeing massive institutional money come into the space. Recently, Guggenheim Investment Partners, which is a New York-based firm, very renowned firm, recently announced it's going to buy about $500 million worth of Bitcoin. So this, in addition to JP Morgan recently saying they think it could rise to 146K in the long term as it competes with gold. That's like JP Morgan stamped prediction. And so these things that are happening in the space really make you think, what is it going to look like in 5 to 10 years? Certainly volatile on its journey is my prediction. But as a recent fund manager, that he's an icon, Bill Miller, he mentioned recently, I liked his quote. It was, if you're going to hold this asset, basically be prepared for volatility. If you don't, you know, if you're not ready for volatility, you don't own it, you know, buy bonds. And that's cool too. But I think for some of the younger, aggressive, more aggressively focused investors, really you want to pick the fastest horse. So this could be a fast one. It's certainly shown to be a fast horse across the through the years, but certainly expect volatility moving forward.
Now we've seen players like that. Square had bought like what, $50 million of Bitcoin specifically, and and you know, other institutional investors. You know, we see more support from Coinbase, and Gemini Exchange, I was mentioning, has been more mature. How much of this is institutional investors, or is that just just a small blip on what's going on now?
Well, so it's a good question, John. So what I've been reading and hearing across the industry is that the difference between the bull run now and in 2017 is that this one seems like it's primarily fueled, at least significantly fueled, by institutional money. So, you know, in 2020 and this year, you know, everything hits a little different. Have you heard that? Like, you know, the meme hits different. The bull run this time, I feel like it's hitting different. I think it's more institutional money. It's bigger sums of cash that are going into this asset or into Bitcoin. And these bigger players are like, you know, they're large institutions that aren't really day trading. They're not just, you know, trying to make a buck off the top. They're thinking more when they make their evaluations, they think more medium and long-term. So to the extent that that's indicative of their sort of long-term view for this asset class, I think it's important to look at that.
Yeah, and it seems very Bitcoin-centered. I mean, Ethereum has gone up a little bit, not quite as much. And XRP, the third largest still cryptocurrency, has really tanked on this determination that it's a security, it looks like. We got pushed off of some of the exchanges. I think Bitstamp stopped trading it. Coinbase, got rid of it, but you know, stopped trading, because until regulatory clearance or clarity on the regulatory situation became more apparent.
I think that there were also some allegations around some let's say some less than ethical behavior on the part of the founders, right? In terms of how they were using Ethereum, right? Or Ripple, sorry.
XRP. Yeah, I think the Ripple team is sort of seen a lot of this regulation fall down on them, and I think there's a lot of space for maturity in this industry as both companies understand how to operate in the regulatory environment, but also as the government creates the regulations to appropriately monitor and appropriately regulate the environment. So I think it's like kind of a learning stage for both the market and the regulators. The Ripple case is interesting. I mean, it just goes to show that a lot of the times there's the government needs to work harder at and think smarter about regulation in this space. And asking the right questions to the Ripple team was certainly an important kind of evolution in the regulatory space. But we'll see what happens with them. I'm excited to see what lessons we learn as a result of what's happening with XRP. I think you're seeing some really interesting things coming out of DC with regulation. The opposite of the currency comptroller it's a really cool name. And
not when you're getting audited by them.
XRP probably doesn't love them at all. That doesn't think they're a cool name. But I think, you know, that office has done a good job at working with the SEC and creating sort of the regulatory on-ramps for kind of navigating this ambiguous space. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. They've definitely pushed back for a while on being classified as a security. So, but yeah, it hasn't been clear. So these announcements make big waves for sure.
There's no boring moment in the space. The volatility is not just in the price, but also in just sort of like how the space operates. So it's certainly a wild ride, but we're we're excited to see how this pans out.
Yeah, one thing we can count on for sure is more volatility in 2021. So, Steve, what do you think will happen in 2021?
What will happen in 2021? I think that from a public health perspective, we'll get to about 85% of the way to a normal year, hopefully. I think that we've seen how there's been a lot of emphasis now on fixing the supply chain for the vaccine, but that's sort of neither here nor there. On the fintech side, I think that we'll see a lot of M&A activity in 2021. And here's why. All these valuations that we've talked about before basically means that these companies are flush with cash now, and they're able to sort of, like SoFi did, acquire maybe older, more established, more old line technology companies. So we'll see a spree of M&A activity within the fintech space, mostly by younger companies buying quote unquote older, more established ones.
Interesting. Sean, what do you predict for 2021?
I think it'll be interesting for payday advance companies this year. I think we had earlier talked about Even, which has done a really good job at helping folks who need their paycheck early. I think this will be an interesting year for that group. I think as so many Americans are still suffering as a result of the pandemic, I think people are going to look to those services for help. And I think a lot of those services are well positioned to really help people make ends meet and in this tough economy.
All right. So good bet in that area then, huh?
That's a good one.
We'll see.
How about you, John?
I'll go with JP Morgan acquiring Coinbase. You know, they made a deal a few months ago where JP Morgan now provides the banking services for Coinbase, which they didn't have. And I think JP Morgan will just go ahead and swallow the whole thing and take Coinbase under their wing in a new growing market.
This would be an amazing about face, right? To go from crypto skeptics to now acquiring Coinbase.
And Jamie Dimon will be forced to eat his words. That's right.
Yes. Eat so much crow, Jamie. Wow.
Well, despite what he said, JP Morgan's been moving forward on their Onyx project, which is supporting cryptocurrency services. And I think a quick way for them to just boost up the number one position will be taking and acquiring Coinbase. So let's see if that happens. You heard it here first, if any of those things come to pass. Well, there'll be lots for us to talk about in 2021 for sure. Thanks for keeping up with FinTech with us. And please hit subscribe. Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Steve.